March 19th, 2015. I'm your host, Polk Runyon, and this is the Hermetic Hour, running a little bit late tonight. And tonight we have a very, very rare treat for you. Dr. Claire Fitzpatrick, a distinguished Hermetic healer and a broadcaster of her own magically related podcasts, also an associate member of the Church of Hermetic Sciences since 2011, will share with us her recent interview with the Hermetic Hour host, that's myself, Polk Runyon, and this interview is, in a way, very similar to last week's biographical interview we did with Merrick Rees-Hamer. Now, Polk told Dr. Claire that she got him to remember things that he thought he had forgotten. Now, we will preface the interview with a short biographical introduction to Claire and her work, and also her equally distinguished life partner and colleague, Masonic scholar and alchemist, Ariel Malachi Sirocco, also an associate member of CHS. So, as we said, tune in and find out what our East Coast folks are doing and enjoy the secrets she managed to coax out of old Frater Fabian. Now, first, let me apologize for being a little late getting on. We had some technical problems with this because we're downloading this interview. But the technical problems were all solved by our stalwart engineer and producer, Sorors Andreas. She did a really terrific job of getting this thing back on the air. So anyway, let's talk first about Dr. Fitzpatrick. Claire Fitzpatrick is a doctor of chiropractic in New York City. She teaches chiropractic, which is essentially hermetic and philosophy, natural longevity, and ecstatic ritual in Western wisdom traditions. Now, she began her occult studies in the late 1980s while pursuing her Master of Fine Arts in Poetry at Bowling Green, Ohio. She is a fourth-degree high priestess in the Minoan tradition of Wicca since 1995. You hear that, Joe Carson? But has moved on to a broader study of the Western wisdom traditions. Her podcast, Places to Go with Dr. Claire, espouses a chiropractic lifestyle, while her new podcast, The Compass, co-hosted with Ariel Sirocco, is dedicated to more occult pursuits. She is an associate member of the Church of the Hermetic Sciences since 2011, and she's also the author of The Nine Essentials of Health, and her poetry is featured in the anthology From La Via to the Village, due out in May 2015. She is also experiencing what she says is a midlife crisis, expressed by learning Sligo-style Irish fiddle under the tutelage of a master fiddler, Brian Conway. And you could find out more about her at drclairefitzpatrick.com. That's all one word, drclaircoaire Fitzpatrick.com. And New York City Cairo, CHIRO.com. Now, her life partner and colleague, Ariel Malachi Sirocco, is a teacher of Western esoteric history and traditions, a hermetic alchemist, and a 32nd degree Freemason of the Scottish Rite. Ariel has been a practicing occultist since 1983. He has an academic background in biology and 15 years with the American Museum of Natural History. He was initiated as a high priest of the Minoan Temple Incorporated of New York in 1998 and the Temple of the Spiral Path, New York City, in 2004. He is one of the top three Masonic officers within Union Lodge No. 5 in Connecticut. He is also an associate member of the Church of the Hermetic Sciences since 2011. He teaches Western mysticism and magical manifestation and is a regular presenter and speaker on hermetic alchemical principles, meditation, trance, Western shamanism, and elements of ritual and he performs public rituals, ceremonies, workshops, and classes throughout the East Coast. Ariel is currently writing a body of knowledge encompassing principles garnered from his years of study, and that promises to be quite a book. And like I said, you can catch up on both of these great people at those websites that we mentioned. That's drclairefitzpatrick.com and newyorkcitycairo.com. And that said, this interview that Dr. Claire did with me turned out very, very well, I think. And so we're going to go ahead right on into it, and we'll try to catch you up at the end and tell you what's coming in the future. So stay with us and enjoy it.
So thank you for coming on The Compass. I really appreciate you doing this and taking time out of your day. We gave you an introduction in the beginning. You prefer Polk to Carroll, correct?
I prefer Polk, and it's kind of a nickname, pen name. I used it in my writing career back when I was doing paperback thrillers, you know, it's been, you know, it's stuck with me, but for magical purposes, I'm Frater Thabion, and that sometimes gets people get that confused with Therion, which Crowley used. That was a Greek word for beast, and Crowley thought he was, of course, the great beast, and so he used Master Therion. But I use Thabion, and Thabion, according to one of the ancient Mediterranean philosophers, Sancho Niathan, Thabion was the first high priest among the Phoenicians. And so I thought that would be, and seeing as how the pagan part of our tradition is ancient Phoenician, I thought that would be a good magical name. So that's, I use that. So you can call me either Polk or Frater Thabion, either one. I answer to both.
Can you tell us, I gave an introduction about you before the podcast started. Can you let us know something about you, the person, as well as you, the teacher?
Me, the person. Oh, boy. Well, that gets pretty introspective, but then we have a motto, and we put it on all our correspondence. Nosce te ipsum, know yourself. And this was, of course, over the, you know, the cave of the Oracle of Delphi, as I'm sure you know. And then at the end of the correspondence, we say the second half of it, tu es Deus, you are God. And which does not mean that you are the one and only God. It just means that you've got some of the one and only God in you. So along the line with that, know yourself. That's what I've been trying to do that for years. And I gotta tell you the truth, Claire. I'm still learning things about myself. I am. I'm learning things about myself that and a lot of them go way, way back to my, you know, to my childhood and all, and I'm continually learning things about myself. And here I am, you know, just about to turn 80, and I feel like I'm in a constant state of self-discovery. So to tell you about myself, basically, I was born in 1935 in St. Petersburg, Florida, which is a tourist town on the west coast of Florida. And I grew up partly in Georgia during World War II, and also spent summers in Pennsylvania during World War II or before.
Oh, wow.
But so I have a, you know, I'm kind of a well, I'm a Southerner and also a Northeastern Seaboard Yankee too, kind of. You know, I'm kind of an East Coast kind of a guy.
Oh yeah.
And But I got to tell you though, I went to New York City when I was 7 years old, and I didn't like it.
So. It's changed a little bit since then.
You got to love it, but I didn't. I my feet got real tired. But in fact, I told my mother. I said, she said, "Are you getting tired?" I said, "No." I said, "I'm not. I'm fetally tired." But anyway, that was from at least we liked the Bronx Zoo anyway. I grew up in an era in which children still, you know, had read to them and read fairy tales and the Oz books and things like that. A lot of that got suppressed right after World War II. There was a lot of this romantics, children's literature got actually taken out of the children's libraries and burned.
No kidding.
A lot of people don't know that, but this is true. This culture war that we're in right now has been going on for a long time, by the way. I grew up, but I grew up when kids still read romantic literature and all, and we didn't have we weren't doing the dark side versions of Snow White and all, and at that time we were doing the original Hans Christian Andersen stuff and all that, and my mother read me fairy tales and the Oz books until I started reading them myself, and so I grew up in a very much a creature of the mythology of the children and young people were steeped in at that time. And the King Arthur stories. And I got started as a romantic, and I came from an army family. My whole family was army, and my uncle and my father both rode the Pacific during World War II. And my daddy told me all kinds of war stories, my uncle didn't tell me too many war stories because the war was a little harder on him than it was on my dad. But my dad told me a whole bunch of war stories, and my dad even created an Indiana Jones kind of character to create stories to tell me, he had his character called Ben Smith, and he used to tell me these Ben Smith adventures when I was a little kid. And Ben Smith was kind of an Indiana Jones character, and so I grew up. I wanted to be, and then I went from the Oz books to the Burroughs books, John, and I read all the John Carter stories and went, oh boy, I was also an artist and kind of a comic book style, cartoon style or comic book style artist. And I wanted to be a writer of adventure stories. I wanted to be another Edgar Rice Burroughs, and I wanted to write adventure stories. And of course, I knew that in order to write adventure stories, you got to have adventures. And so I grew up being a teenager, I was into sailing and spearfishing and all kinds of every kind of adventure that Florida would offer, I was into. And I continued that in college, being in the Speleological Society. We had a lot of caves in Florida. And I was exploring caves, both in dry caves and underwater, which is probably the most dangerous sport in the world. I was a bear for adventure. I was just, because I wanted to write about it.
You sound like Hemingway.
Really, my writing style was more Victorian than Hemingway. It was my biggest influence in writing, I think, was Edgar Rice Burroughs. But I'm in good company because Michael Moorcock was influenced by Edgar Rice Burroughs too. So, I grew up with a guy who eventually became the grandmaster of fantasy. In the literary world, Lynn Carter. And Lynn Carter, and he was our mentor in our science fiction club and when I was growing up in high school and all that. And Lynn eventually became the fantasy editor for Ballantine Books in New York.
Right.
And he introduced the Tolkien series, you know, the Ring series, and all of the associated old fantasy classics, that romantic fantasy, magical kind of stuff, to the American readers. So, in fact, they called, he was Grand Master of the Sword and Sorcery Society, and he was a good friend of mine, and a mentor, and even helped me with a book that I ended up publishing. That's Drill Master. I got a couple of adventure stories available right now that I wrote in the last few years.
Terrific!
Naturally, I'm gonna plug them a little bit.
Yeah.
That's from the Tower of Darkness, and that was one that was kind of inspired by my favorite film when I was a kid. My favorite film was the old Alexander Korda version of Four Feathers. I don't know whether you've ever seen it, but basically it's this little kid Harry Faversham, who grows up in an army family, and he hears all these war stories all the time, and they're kind of grisly, they're all the families are expecting him to go off to war and get his head blown off like a good boy should and all that kind of stuff, you know, and Harry really doesn't want to. He's kind of a little bit of a sissy, and he doesn't really want to live up to this military tradition. So But you know, he goes to the British version of West Point, and this could, and you know, please his family and all of that. But when the British go to war in the Sudan, and his regiment is called in, he turns in his commission and he says, I'm not going. Tells his girlfriend, who's a general's daughter, that I just can't do this. You know, he said, I don't believe in it, and I can't do it. And all of his friends, including his girlfriend, give him a white feather. And, you know, he's a coward. And he takes these white feathers, and then he starts drinking himself into a stupor, and he's going to commit suicide. And then one of his old family friends talks him out of it. So he decides to redeem himself by going off to Egypt as a civilian and becoming a kind of a secret agent. And he manages to rescue all his friends in various situations and had a lot of exciting adventure and whatever. And this thing really inspired me. I finally ended up doing a novel, which I eventually turned into a screenplay. It's called From the Tower of Darkness, and of course the novel is available on Amazon. And the screenplay, well, we got some pretty good response on the screenplay, but I don't think I don't think it's gonna go anywhere. But the novel is available, and this thing really resonated. This thing had a lot to do with my life. I mean, because I ended up just about to flunk out of college, and of course my parents had sent me to college, and you know they paid for it and everything, but I just wasn't ready for it, and I kept telling them I wanted to go in the Army before college, but they wouldn't let me. And so when I was about to get drafted, I said, no, I'm not gonna let them draft me. I'm gonna go down and I'm gonna enlist. And first I wanted to join the Marines, and my dad said, no son of mine's gonna be a Marine. So anyway, off I went to the Army recruiter, and I walked into the Army recruiting office, and I said, my dad won't let me join the Marines. He says we're an Army family, and I got to join the Army, but I want something tough. You got anything tough? And the sergeant looked at me like I was kind of weird, you know. And he says, "What is this kid?" You know, he says, "How do you want tough?" And he opened up, he pulled out the drawer, and he pulled out this little brochure showing a guy with a great big rucksack on his back climbing up a mountain, vertical slope, with a rope, persicking up. And he said, "Does this look tough enough for you?" And it says, "Anything, any place, anytime, anyhow, special forces." I said, yeah, that looks tough enough for me. I'll take it. And so I took it. So I did, you know, off I went to Fort Jackson and for basic and then advanced infantry and then off to jump school at Fort Benning and then from there to Fort Bragg and Smoke Bomb Hill and so I was one of the first guys to wear a green beret.
Oh wow, really?
Oh yeah, and in those days we were really lucky because if you're into that kind of thing, because we had a lot of European partisans from World War II who had worked with the OSS. These were guerrilla fighters from Europe, a lot of them from Eastern Europe. And these guys, really, you know, they really had lived the whole guerrilla warfare thing, you know, against the Nazis. And they knew all the tricks of the trade and you know how to sabotage stuff and how to do all kinds of things. So we really it was quite an experience. It was and we had a lot of the Hungarian freedom fighters that came over and they joined up, and so we were sort of an American Foreign Legion, and it was a lot of fun.
Wow.
And I ended up, because I was a scuba diver, I ended up going down to Key West for Naval Underwater Swimmer School. And that was great. And later I went to Jungle Warfare School in the reserve, you know, and I got a lot of good schools, and radio code school, and although I was never very good at sending Morse code, but still, you know, I went through it. And we had a lot of great training and a lot of fun, and I jumped out of a lot of airplanes, and it was a great experience, and it was kind of, but in a way, it was sort of inspired by that old film Four Feathers. I was what I finally did, I made a suggestion to improve training, which they ended up adapting, but in the course of doing that, they decided to send me to OCS, to Officer Candidate School. So, and I knew my folks would like that because they wanted me to be an ROTC, you know, and be an officer and all. So off I went to OCS and got my gold bar, and then I went, instead of going any further, going back, I took an early out and went back to college. I figured that at that point I had the GI Bill and I was ready for college at that point. So I did that and went back to Florida State University and got myself a bachelor's degree in commercial art because, I'm an artist. Well, you know, from there, then I graduated from FSU, went back to St. Pete, and did several things. I started writing my first novel, my first thriller novel, Night Jump Cuba, and this was a really good story about a super secret rocket engine that we had that ended up. The Russians directed it to land in Cuba, and then we had to send a team of operators in to get it out. And of course, I had all my special forces experience, and I'd been down to Cuba back before the Castro Revolution, so I knew something about Cuba.
Oh my God.
So Night Jump Cuba was my first adventure novel, and I followed that up with another Cuban exile kind of a thing, Commando X. Which is another good, and that both of those, by the way, are still available. One time, one of the senior officers up at Bragg called me into his office, and he said, "You know, they're suppressing your book." And I said, "Well, it wouldn't surprise me because, of course, the powers that be were kind of trying to make it up to Castro after the Bay of Pigs, which was sad. So my books were not really top priority, you know."
Yeah.
And then I had a a series of short stories in Argosy magazine. And these were all based on underwater adventures, and they were basically underwater sailing kind of things. What I'd like to do is I'd like to get those together and republish them, you know, in book form, because I have enough of them for a book. So I was probably what you would might call the last of the old pulp fiction writers, and so for a while there I was you know, doing real good, and then I decided, well, you know, I've had enough of Florida and the opportunities here. I think I'll go out to California and see if I can write for the movies, because I kind of wanted to do that too. And I wanted to, you know, so I did, and I drove out here in 1966. I came out to Los Angeles, and fortunately, when I drove in, it was not a smoggy day. It was a nice clear day, and I thought, oh boy, this is beautiful, you know. But because I was a New York published author, I got myself a real good agent, and with a very good agency, and started working on screenplays. And you know, I got a treatment written, and we sent it over to 20th Century Fox, and they want to take an option on it. I had an idea about a wealthy blind woman with a seeing eye dog that this swindler that's romancing her decides to switch dogs on her and have her killed by her own dog, you know, so the title of this thing was Beware of the Dog. Aww. And 20th Century Fox wanted to give me an option on it to develop it, and instead of that, my agent said, let's do an independent production. So that turned out to be a disaster. It turned out to be something like Springtime for Hitler, and I had to bail out, and that was the end of my movie career. And in the process of that, I was, you know, doing odd jobs. But finally, through the Army Reserve, I met a guy who worked for Shelby American, the guy that does the cars, you know, the Cobra and the souped up Mustangs, the GT350s and all that. And he had a factory down by LAX. So I started working for him as an artist and a designer, and I designed some of his logos. And so I worked for Carroll Shelby, and I think one of the reasons why he hired me was because my first name was Carroll, and so it was his, you know. But I did real good with Shelby, but while this was going on, I was still trying to work on Beware the Dog, and that was going down. But what happened at this point is I developed a hell of an illness, and this was something that had been coming on for quite a while. And it was misdiagnosed as an ulcer, as a duodenal ulcer. Well, it was not a duodenal ulcer. What it was an atrophied gallbladder. And literally, my gallbladder had turned to solid rock. And this was caused by my dear mother and my various southern black mammies had... They all believed that bacon grease was God's gift to the kitchen. They cooked everything in bacon grease. Mm. I mean, they soaked potatoes in bacon grease.
I was born in the South. I know they do that.
Oh, God. I mean, soul food. Soul food almost killed me. however, it almost killed me, but it was also responsible for my getting into magic, and the reason was this: this pain that I was having was diagnosed as duodenal ulcer. So I thought, well, at that time, the general opinion was that duodenal ulcers were psychological, you know, and you attack them by changing your attitude, you know, that's what I tell you. I went into self hypnosis. I thought, well, I can take care of this by self hypnosis. Well, no, you can't dissolve an atrophy. unfortunately, self-hypnosis will not dissolve it. So, but what self-hypnosis did do, because I was in extreme pain, what it did accomplish was it really got me into some very deep altered states of consciousness, and I was able to really get deep into it. And that, of course, in the course of that, I was reading Evans Wentz's Tibetan compilations and studying Tibetan Tantra and reading, you know, Carl Jung and reading. And I was reading all this material in mystical kind of material, from a Tibetan kind of, trying to take a Buddhist Tibetan perspective on it. At about that time, nobody of mine who was a former member of one of my special forces team that I had. I had a special forces team in St. Petersburg in the reserve, and I was the captain. And one of my sergeants had come out to California and was living there. And he gave me, for my birthday, he gave me a copy of Richard Cavendish's The Black Arts. Now, this is still, and I think it's still available, and I think it's in present. I think it's still in print. This is one of the best surveys on Western magic that's ever been written. This is a really great book. And I read this, and I thought, oh boy, this is it. There were things about Tibetan Buddhism that just didn't resonate with me, but this was great.
What didn't resonate? What didn't resonate about Tibetan Buddhism for you?
I went much deeper. You know, as you probably know, I actually practiced and did the Vajrayogini program with the Sakya order eventually, but what didn't resonate with me was the absolute abnegation, you know, of it, and of course eventually the idea of learning that the Buddhists they believe everything is illusion, everything, including yourself and God and everything else. There is this is a uniquely Eastern kind of a perspective, like nothing exists at all, and everything is Maya, everything is illusion. And I'm more of a Westerner, and I think that the imagination, and I think that the spiritual world has a certain measure of reality to it. And I'm also, and at the same time, I was studying Neoplatonism, and I was beginning to realize that you can create things in your imagination, and they will come about. Either events or you can bring people to you. You can create things. You can imagine certain objects of art and create them, or they will, or find them if you're a collector. I believe in the power of the imagination. And the Tibetans will tell you, you know, a lot of times they'll tell you, oh, the imagination is wrong. No, what you imagine, no, that's bad. They'll tell you that. And yet at the same time they say that. Now, this is the interesting thing, the paradox of it. At the same time, they use their imagination to create God forms, which they then, and after they've created them, they reabsorb them. And all of that. So they use their imagination in a creative sense, but they at the same time they're doing that, they'll tell you that the imagination is a negative thing, and you should not be enamored of it and whatever. So there those aspects of Tibetan Buddhism that I don't go along with. What I like to say is this. They say everything is illusion. Everything. And the mind is illusion. The self is illusion. God is illusion. Everything is illusion. I say, in the Hermetic philosophy, we think and we believe everything is And that includes imagination and vision and everything. Everything is a measure of reality. It's just a different measure. It's reality on a different plane. And this is why the Kabbalah, the concept of the Kabbalah with the four worlds of emanation and all, why this is so important to the Western magician. Because the zero dimension in the tree of life, this is the formative world. This is where things are formed that will come to pass and will manifest down in Malkuth. You know, my friend Lon Duquette uses Plato's analogy of the chair.
Yes.
And if you recall from the Chicken Kabbalah of Rabbi Lamed Ben Clifford is a delightful book. but he uses Plato's analogy of the chair and about up there, you know, way up in Bria, the engineering department up there in Bria, you know, they're looking up at Catherine and God's up there and God says, rest. And then, you know, the folks in the head of the engineering department in Bria, he says, God wants a chair. And so they communicate that downstairs to the draftsman and the engineering department down there where they got the drawing boards and the boys on the drawing boards and said, design a chair. And so they do, and they design the chair and they come up with renderings and plans and blueprints and everything, specs and whatever. And then the chair is on the showroom floor, you know.
Where are we?
And so consequently, this does not, this kind of thinking does, the Tibetans actually, their magic works this way, but they don't validate this philosophy. So that's
very clarifying.
Yeah. So back to my story of the yellow kid in the old comic books. This is the story of my sweet life. But anyway, I'm a good one on the history of comics because I love comics because I'm that kind of an artist. But if I'd gone to New York instead of going to Los Angeles, I probably would have ended up in the Marvel bullpen.
Hmm.
But instead of that, I ended up in the Swanson Agency out in Hollywood. But so I had my gallbladder out surgically, and they had to tear me half apart to do it, and I still haven't completely recovered from that.
Really?
But
I
ended up with a naval hernia based on that problem. which I'm trying to lose weight enough, and I'm going to get it. Even at my age, I'm going to get the naval hernia fixed if I can lose enough weight.
Okay, good.
That's why I'm hiking every morning. Anyway, I had the gallbladder out, but before I had the gallbladder out, I had been experimenting, and after reading the Black Arts, I'd been experimenting trying to visualize spirits, especially on Astarte and the Levant, because Cavendish made it very clear in the Black Arts that the two principal spirits of the Lamagitan, Baal, who was the first spirit, and Astarte, Astaroth, who was the 26th, that they were Baal and Astarte, and they had been demonized and put down in this brass vessel in the Lamagitan. So this is what I was trying to do, and this is before I had my surgery. I was experimenting with various methods of conjuring these spirits to visible appearance. And I read about the dark mirror facial reflection method in Elmar Garrison's book, The Tantra Yoga of Sex. And this also, by the way, I read about it in Tantra, the Yoga of Sex, but it's also, Amarc was using it in their neophyte section for previous incarnations, which I found out later after, you know. But it works for both. It works for spirits and for previous incarnations, because goetia spirits are portions of the human mind. and Crowley, of course, stated that. Except he said the human brain, and that's the wrong way to put it.
Right.
There are aspects of the human mind, not the brain. And you can relate them to fragments of the Jungian shadow if you want to. I did these experiments until I finally realized that I could use this facial reflection, dark mirror facial reflection method to actually bring these spirits and that put the sigil on the mirror, you know, and use your reflection to transform your and when you get the blackout and then your face comes back in, that it would be distorted and it would be your aspect of the spirit. The part of the spirit that belongs to you, you know, and because as here again the quote Lon, he said we're all born with 12 six packs of Galatia spirits, and so if you accept the idea that those 72, along with the 72 angels that control them, that these are all aspects of your of your mind, and the Galatic spirits, they not only represent the rebellious parts of your psyche, but they're also the creative parts of your psyche. This is something that is that needs to be emphasized with this, because if you notice, if you read through the Galatia, that it seems like this thing was created. I think it was created in a Spanish university by a bunch of students to get themselves through exams. Because all of these spirits teach something, usually an academic subject of some sort. As a matter of fact, I used Asmodeus to get me through statistics in graduate school. Well, it was a mathematical klutz, and when I was in graduate school later on, going in anthropology, because, you know, before I did my Tibetan thing, I had to do several things in order to round out my magical career. One of them was to get a master's degree in anthropology, which I did, and wasn't easy, but by gosh, it was worth it, because anthropology, if you're going to be a magician, that's the real subject but in order to be an anthropologist, you have to master statistics, and I always was kind of a mathematical klutz. In fact, I had problem getting through high school algebra, and my folks hired me a tutor, but God, oh boy, she was so good looking, I couldn't concentrate. and I discovered, but through statistics, I discovered the secret of geomancy, of our geomancy method, and it accomplished that, but also, in order to get through it, I summoned Asmodeus, who teaches mathematics, and I charged him to get me through statistics. So I aced the midterm. I mean, I was absolutely perfect, and top of the curve on the midterm. But then I flunked the final. And it was because Asmodeus is also the demon of confusion, and I got very confused in the final. But I passed the course anyway, because everybody else flunked the final too.
So
I passed the course, and he was both the teacher of mathematics and also the demon of confusion, and he did both. Anyway, so as I said, I discovered this method. And when I recovered, after I had my gallbladder out and I recovered, then I was kind of nutty. In fact, I called it one time a toxic psychosis when I was affected by this inflammation and everything resulting from this gallbladder, and hypnotizing myself every day and doing all this. So I think I was kind of nuts. And I don't mind that, because under the circumstances I had every right to be. But when I got my gallbladder out, and after I recovered to some degree, and I returned to a normal state of mind, then I said, wait a minute, I wonder if this will still work. And sure enough, it did. And that's when I decided that I ought to do something, and you know, I had something here. I really had something, and I could start a, you know, I could start a group of, you know, start a group of people doing this sort of thing. Start a little magical lodge, and so this is what I set out to do, and this was in 1969, by the way.
Yeah.
So we really got the OTA really got started in there. When I say the OTA, that's the Order of the Temple of Astarte, because the first the Astarte, the goddess, was the first was the old Phoenician goddess or Canaanite goddess, and you know, kind of the Arabian Nights princess of the jinn, so to speak. And she was the first one that I did, and then of course I did her consort, Prince Baal, the original horn god. Now, one of the things that I want to point out about this is that this Baal and Astarte are really at the time I did this, the witchcraft movement was really going strong, especially in the Los Angeles area. And you know, Anfred, Gardnerian, or whatever, however you want to, whatever tradition you want to mention, Alexandrian, whatever. But it was really going strong, and they were emphasizing the goddess and the horned god, and they called this the old religion. But what they didn't realize was that their old religion was really pre-biblical, and it was really it came from the original Baal and Astarte, or Tammuz and Ishtar on the other side of the Jordan. But Baal and Astarte evolved all the way through. They evolved all the way through the centuries. They evolved all the way to Jesus and Mary Magdalene.
You've drawn that path. I've heard that path before in your podcast.
Well, this isn't just my opinion. This is a fact. In fact, the Gnostics, the so-called Nicene Gnostics, they actually had this philosophy. They started with Isis and Osiris, which of course are an Egyptian counterpart to Baal and Astarte.
Yeah.
Also, I very quickly on read Jesse Weston's Ritual of Romance, in which she traces it all the way from ancient Canaan, the Holy Grail, all the way from ancient Canaan, all the way through to to southern France and to Glastonbury and whatever. So I thought that at this point that I had something that I could start and get people involved in, and we could progress with this, and I wanted to do it. So I found a guy who was sympathetic to this idea, and he kind of wanted to start something like this too. And this is my friend Nelson White, and this guy, he was a kind of a jackleg lawyer, and so he got us incorporated as the Church of the Hermetic Sciences. And of course, the first thing the Church of the Hermetic Sciences did when it got incorporated, and it got incorporated actually, the incorporation was approved in October of 1970, and finally in January 1971 it was finally official. But it was approved on October 23rd, 19. I like that October 23rd, because that's the day that Bishop Usher said the world was created. You know, according to his calculation of all the begats in Genesis,
right.
And he said the word. Yeah. So I like that. But however, it was actually officially approved in January of 1971. And the first thing we did, of course, was to charter, the church did, was to charter the Order of the Temple of Astarte. And that gave us, you know, that gave us a legal, you know, a kind of a legal footing. And then we, of course, we started, giving classes and initiating people. And we were very, very lucky in the initiation situation, and I'll explain that. Almost all of these orders, with the exception of the witchcraft covens. The witchcraft covens, of course, Gardner's original Book of Shadows, Rex Nemerensis, whatever, was their document that they either used or a version thereof, you know. So we needed, if we wanted to have any kind of credibility with the occult community, and we needed a tradition, you know, we needed a tradition to hang ourselves on. And the Golden Dawn at that time, I read it over. I got the two-volume set that came out in 69. I read it over, and I thought, oh, gosh, this is full of great information and all that, but, oh, boy, it sure is ponderous. And it's ponderous, and it's not dramatic, and or at least I don't see the drama in it and all of that. And I thought, oh, boy. And, well, and then, of course, there wasn't anything available right when we started on the OTO. We from our British connections, we received all the OTO rituals in Crowley's own handwriting, but we never used them. I ended up finally, when they started to fade out, I gave them all to Lon Duquette. But not that they didn't already have them, but they had them. But we had this copy and sitting around, and it was kind of fading out, and it was old fashioned thermal fax kind of stuff. And I gave them to Lon, you know, because you know, we decided we just didn't want to do OTO, and I couldn't get along with Grady McMurtry anyway. But what we used as our tradition was the Kreiteropoa from the 1775, just around about the same time as, you know, the United States was founded. 1775, a committee of German Masons scholars tried to recreate a seven-degree system based upon the Alexandrian mysteries. So they collected all of the material they could on the Alexandrian mysteries, and they put together 7 degrees of their reconstruction of an Alexandrian mystery school. Mm-hmm. And they called it Kreiteropoa. At that time, I was not aware that Manly Hall had, since 1935, had published John Yarker's version of it in an English translation. I wasn't aware of that, but what we had was Paul Christians, who was a contemporary of Eliphas Levy, a French 1 degree version of all 7 degrees. They packed all 7 degrees into 1 degree in Paul Christians' History and Practice of Magic. And we based our original initiation, on that 1 degree wrap-up of the whole Kreiteropoa system. And oh boy, it was terrific. And we had all these ordeals and all this. It was really great. And because it was so complex and because it had so much information in it, we had a long probationary period. We had people going through a long probationary period before they'd ever get this thing. And for years, up until, oh, gee, up until about 1974 or something like that, it was the only degree we had. We just had this one initiation, and you were in. And then after that, we tried to follow the Golden Dawn structure after that one, and we had, you know, practicus, philosophers, and all that. But following it, but then by 75 or so, we discovered Manly Hall's. Oh, I stumbled into Manly Hall's Freemasonry of the Ancient Egyptians, which had an English version of the French version of the German version of Kreiteropoa by John Yarker. It had a lot of errors and one thing or another in it, but at least it was all 7 degrees. And that, at that point, we realized that we ought to, and we had enough, you know, enough power going at that point, and that we'd been around a while. And well, we better go ahead and do the whole system. So we did. We started and had the first one. We called the first one Pastor Forrest, the Fellowship of the Grail, and we made that, you know, kind of. We used Craterpillar basically as an outline. And we ended up, because of the way it's laid out, we ended up using different elements of different degrees and kind of putting them in different places where we thought they belonged. So our version of Crater Rapport is not really what you see in Crater Rapport. But we ended up, because of that, we call it Crater Rapport Reformado. In other words, a reformed version of the Crater Rapport, because we've got all the elements in Crater Rapport, but they're in different places in the degree system. And I think that Crater Rapport, and by the way, we published a German version of Crater Rapport, which we published in the third Seventh Ray, our journal, the Seventh Ray, the Green Ray. So if anybody wants to study Crater Rapport and the way we're doing it, they can go on Amazon, or if you're an associate member, you get it for half price. That's the Seventh Ray, Book 3, the Green Ray, and it's got the whole German version of the Crater Rapport in there, annotated and all. So we've taken. By the way, I should mention that one of the bedrocks of our system are our Canaanite seasonal ceremonies, which are derived from the Rosh Hashanah tablets from ancient Canaan, and the myth of Baal and Astarte, and the yearly death of Baal and his resurrection. And Baal was, you know, one of the original dying gods. The last one of the dying gods, of course, was Jesus. And the last manifestation of Astarte, of course, was Mary Magdalene. So that's the sequence in which that goes. But the seasonal ceremonies are all based on the first part, the four primal operations of alchemy. That is, if you follow Ripley, through the seasons. And the operations of calcination in the summertime, and solution in the fall, and separation in the winter, and conjunction in the spring, and the Pestiferous initiation, the first initiation that we do, it symbolizes this whole process, and he replicates it in an alchemical operation that we go around the henge with. And I say the henge because we have an outdoor temple that we use here and elsewhere, where we have 8 menhirs, each one representing a planet, around in a circle. And this forms a magic circle, and it also forms an outdoor temple. And if you design one of these things correctly, you can pull it up, stick it in the back of your truck, and haul it around, and take it off into the woods, and set it up, and anywhere you want, and you've got an outdoor temple. Okay, this gives you a pretty good idea of what we do and all. What questions would you like to ask about any of this?
How did you? Was it the books that you got started with when you were young that led you to this path? Why did your friend give you that book back in the Black Arts, the Army? What?
The reason why Pat gave me the Black Arts is because he knew that I was interested in this sort of thing, and he had a catalog. He belonged to I don't know whether it was the Science Fiction Book Club or he belonged to some kind of a book club, and he showed me the catalog for the book club, and he said, your birthday's coming up, or look in here and see what you'd like to. And I saw this ad for the Black Arts, and I said, oh, that looks good, Pat, if you want to get me that. So he did. But Pat, you know, he knew I was in a adventure story writer. You know, he knew that because he'd been with me in St. Pete in our special forces team that we had in the reserve. And so he knew I was, you know, I was a writer, and he knew I had a good imagination. So, you know, that's how that came about. But I think, you know, you follow the Hermetic Hour. You know, I've done several shows on various books and films and all that I think have influenced me in magic and that I recommend to people, you know, as sort of magical inspiration or to having the capacity to inspire or, you know, to give you some kind of a magical perspective. And I've had my friend Curtis Shoemaker, who is a professor who teaches science fiction over at California State, and he's been on the show a couple times, and we've talked about fantasy novels and science fiction that has influenced you know, the occult community and back and forth. And I just recently did one on Michael Moorcock, you know, who, by the way, lives, spends half his time down around Austin, Texas. But Michael Moorcock is very, very much a student of Hermetic magic, and he's the Chaos Magicians owe their symbol to Michael Moorcock. So a lot of the I think that fantasy literature and of course. Well, originally, when you're a kid, if you're into the Oz books, oh boy, L. Frank Baum, who created the Oz books, was a theosophist, and there's a lot of mystical symbolism and all in the Oz books, and so that sort of gets kids, you know, they're into that to start with. That gets them going. So the greatest power that the magician has. Is his or her imagination. That's your power.
Is that something that you learned innately as a child from your father reading you these books? I imagine that you grew up, because you grew up in the South, did you grow up in a Christian household?
Yeah, my mother's very devout. My father wasn't all that. But my mother was a Christian. In fact, she's one of these mothers that took me by the ear and dragged me to church every Sunday morning, you know, and Sunday school and all of that. And you know, brought me, I've still got a Bible that she gave me when I was a little kid. That's one thing that I'm very, very glad that she did that, because I realized, and I said in one of the old seventh rays when we were first getting started, I said that Christians and should never, if you're going to get into this, into the occult or into magic and all that, you should never insult or actually deny or insult Jesus, and if you're Jewish, you should not insult Moses, of course, and as much as you might want to, but don't do that. And the reason is, they're inside you. They're part of your egregore. And so if you want to put them aside for a while, that's fine. But don't attack them. Don't. But that doesn't mean you can't criticize fundamental Christians. God knows they need criticism, and you can certainly criticize fundamental Christians, and you can certainly criticize some very orthodox Jewish people or Jewish people that use the religion the wrong way, you know, and all that. But don't insult your God forms, and don't insult your religious icons, because they're inside you. They live inside you. And this is true. So for a long while I didn't want to, you know, actually have a place for Jesus in our system, because I wanted to get. I had an experience. I went to at one point in my college career, I attended a university that was completely ruled by Baptist ministerial students.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw how cruel they could be, and how they would. They would get kids expelled for having for drinking one beer, you know, something like that, you know, and just really, really cruel. I decided that I just couldn't be a formal Christian after that experience. Like Mahatma Gandhi, you know, when he was over in England, he's a young man, and some newspaper reporter asked him, he said, "Well, Dr. Gandhi, you know, you've become a Westerner in every other way. Have you ever considered becoming a Christian?" And Gandhi looked at him and he said, "Oh, yes, I would, except for those who are." And that was about the way I was. So I didn't want anything to do with formal Christianity after that experience I had at that Baptist University. I was studying art, by the way, at the Baptist University, but they still, the ministerial students, you know, dominated the campus, and anybody that they didn't like, boy, you were in trouble. That's that part of it I just couldn't go along with. However, I'm glad because when I started really getting into this Canaanite background and realized that it was the start of the Grail tradition all the way up through, then in our inner order, which we call the ORC, the Order of Rosy Crucis, we can end up transforming the last transformation, the last dying god and his goddess priestess, and that's when Jesus and Mary Magdalene step in. By the way, a friend of mine over in Lebanon, Karim Kusa, wrote a book called Jesus the Phoenician.
Yes.
And yeah, now he Karim has just emailed me and said that it's coming out in hardback and with a book jacket and our abstract from the Hermetic Hour is on the back as one of the reviews on the back of the book jacket on the back of the hardcover edition of Jesus the Phoenician.
Very good.
So
that's excellent.
Yeah.
So it feels like that you've come like full circle around, like you've found Jesus and Mary again after all these years, and now you have a much clearer understanding than I think a lot of people might.
Well, I think that it's part of our, you know, it's so much a part of our Western tradition, and it's so much a part of our for those of us who grew up in Christian homes. I have complaints about the way it's been misused.
Yeah.
But I do not want to say that Jesus's teachings eclipse the teachings of Hermes Trismegistus, because I think they are equally important. In fact, when you get right down to it, I think Jesus was Hermetic. I think he knew the same teachings that we find in the Pomander and in the Asclepius, the same teachings that are in the Pomander and the Asclepius. I think Jesus originally studied those, and so I see. In fact, the Catholic Church back in the Middle Ages, the late Middle Ages, right before the Renaissance, or in the very early Renaissance, they were ready to canonize Hermes Trismegistus as a saint. So Hermes Trismegistus was aware, the same thing as Jesus was, of the great secret, the great I Am secret. Now, we've discussed this numerous times on the Hermetic Hour, and this is the great secret, and what you're striving for in Hermetic study and incorporating the Kabbalah into yourself and in your psychic centers and in our yoga program and everything else. This is what we're trying to achieve is the I am awareness. And when I say the I am awareness, what I mean is that you have the Spirit of God in you. And you are the eyes, the ears, and the nose of God. You are here to appreciate His creation, and also to take care of it. And you are also expected to respect and nurture your fellow human beings, because they're all equally ensouled. And of course, we have a kind of an elitism in Hermetic philosophy, but then the Christians, Jesus' teachings, he had this same kind of elitism too. Those who are aware of this, who are aware that they are God, you know, that they are self divinity, they're aware of it. They are a special type of person. And this is one of the things we make clear in the Pastor Forrest initiation, you know, that you are the ones who know what you're here for, and you are the ones who know where you're going. And if you do, that's the elitism in Hermetic philosophy. And also you'll find it in Christian philosophy too, especially in the Book of Revelations or whatever. You're one of the 144,000 elect, if you want to look at it that way. You know you're going to heaven because you're already there. Do you follow me?
Yeah.
So that's the big thing. That's the big secret, and that we share that with Christianity. And so I think that I don't want to detract from the value of the Hermetic philosophy. By the way, for those of you who would really like to get the quickest grasp on Hermetic philosophy right from the original source, there's a wonderful little book that Inner Traditions has out called The Way of Hermes.
That's a good starter book. Yeah, that was yeah. You recommended that. I loved it. Yeah, it was a good way to start.
Oh yeah, it's a beautiful little book, and it'll give you the essence of. It's not the complete. It's not the complete Hermetic. It's not the whole Hermetic corpus, but it's enough of it to really, really give you the inspiration and realize the depth and the power of it.
Did you find Hermeticism through your studies of Neoplatonism? Or did your anthropology studies bring you to ancient Phoenicia?
Well, let me put it this way. They did, and when I was studying anthropology, even before I got into graduate school, that was when I started doing this kind of research. So I think it certainly helped. And of course, I did my thesis, my master's thesis, was called the Rise of Magical Cults and the Rise of Neo-Paganism in Southern California. So a lot of that research, you know, where ended up going into my dissertation. By the way, I went along with an anthropological theory about revivalist movements. An anthropologist by the name of Wallace came up with a theory about revivalism, and this is when a culture has a revival of its traditions, and even on a new note. Now, he is one of the examples of that. The ghost dances that the last gasp of the Plains Indians, you know, with their ghost dance. And they actually, that ghost dance was not just Native American religion, they combined it with Christianity. So, but it was still considered a classic revivalist, you know, movement. So what I called Neo-Paganism, the Rise of Neo-Paganism, I combined it with the Renfair phenomenon and the Society for Creative Anachronism and the whole fascination with the Tolkien thing and everything, and I called it a neo-romantic revival. And I tried to subsume the whole thing under the blanket of a neo-romantic movement. And I got a few people to go along with it. By the way, one of the guys that inspired me for on this was Robert Elwood, a professor of comparative religion at USC. He was a good friend of mine and gave us a lot of support. And he's now president of the Theosophical Society in Cortona over in Ojai.
Oh, that's terrific.
Yeah. But Elwood saw all of this, including our sister lodge, Feria, as part of a neo-romantic community, and I went from that, and I expanded on that and included the Society for Creative Anachronism and the science fiction community and everything else as neo-romantic. Well, neo-romanticism. Our neo-romantic idea didn't catch on. I know it was Elwood and myself and Ed Sitch got into it for a while. And we tried to get this neo-romantic thing kind of rolling, but it did anyway, because we have since then, right now, we're having all of these mythological. You know, a lot of them, of course, are coming out of Marvel Comics, but mythological films, Hercules is, how many Hercules movies have we had, and also, so the neo-romanticism did finally find a home in the culture. I think that the Hermetic tradition has a very romantic aspect to it. And if people use this term romanticism, and we call ourselves romantics, and a lot of times people don't understand what that means, and they just don't realize that they think that it's all they can think of is paperback novels with girls riding horses and or being clutched by Fabio or something like that, but no, the term romantic can best be defined as a condition of self enthusiasm. It's the idea a romantic is a person who thinks that he or she has a special commitment to to fight the good fight or join the good cause accomplish some go on the Grail Quest or whatever, you do something spiritually and artistically significant, and it's artistic spiritual self enthusiasm, and romantics believe in doing the right thing, doing the right thing, they appreciate heroics, they heroics and self-realization. I think there's a certain romance to sainthood, that's romantic in its own way. I think that romance needs to be understood. Newt Gingrich has been accused of being a romantic. That's because he's an idealistic conservative and whatever. So I'm very much myself. I'm very much a romantic, and I think magic is a very romantic process. And Hermeticism and the Hermetic tradition is very romantic.
What are three of your core values?
Oh, three of my core values: self-realization, and manifestation of my my purpose, you know, in other words, accomplishing my work, and I have more work that I need to accomplish, and also, I think because I am a believer in reincarnation, and I think knowing where I've been in order to know where I'm going.
That's terrific.
Is that core enough for you?
That's core.
That's core, yeah, right. Yeah. Yeah, what was it that Don Juan Matus said, the enemies of the sorcerer? Fear, old age, and clarity.
Yeah.
So sometimes when you finally achieve clarity, you know that it's your enemy, because you realize, hey, there's not much I can do. I just got to keep doing, and whatever I keep doing, it's just got to be, you know, that's the way it is.
You are so terrifically well-read and knowledgeable. You've just amassed a wealth of information and experience in your life. If you were to go back in time to an earlier version of yourself in this life, when you first started this path, what advice would you give yourself?
Well, I guess I would take the advice that I was given by a friend of mine when he visited me, and when I was first getting into all of this. And I wasn't sure when I was first getting into it just how much I really did believe. And how much I really did believe, and how much I was, you know, going to try to get other people to think I believed. And he told me, he said, you know, if you keep this up, you're going to end up believing it. Because at that point, my friend thought that I was just creating something, you know, for the purpose of having a good time and whatever. He thought it was kind of another one of my fictional projects that I was involved in. And he told me, he said, if you keep this up, you're going to end up believing it. Well, I decided to keep it up, and I decided to believe it. So, I ended up doing that. I kept it up, and sure enough, I ended up believing everything that I was doing.
Excellent. So that's what you would tell yourself, is keep going, you're going to believe it. He was right.
Keep going, believe it. And the most important thing is love. Love is what holds the whole universe together. Love is what holds our relationships together. Love is what holds everything. Everything is the power of love. And we have this transformation mantra, which we use with our yoga and all that. Through me flows a river of unlimited love. And that really does. That's what it's all about, really.
You have another book coming out.
I have the yoga book, and the yoga book will eventually what we're going to do with the yoga book is turn it into a deck of cards. So you'll have all the the entities, you can carry around the whole yoga system in a deck of cards in your pocket. First the book, then the deck of cards. I think we've about covered what you wanted.
Absolutely.
To cover.
Thank you so much for your time. You've been so generous with it. I'm actually going to break this into two episodes. Thank you again. Yeah, this is wonderful. I wanted to give our listeners a taste of who you are, and you've given, as you usually do, over and above what I was hoping. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Claire. I really appreciate it, and we'll see you soon. Okay.